Hi, this is James Murray, artist, writer, editor, and channel for thestarsshine.com. You are listening to the Peaceful Planet song, synthesized from spirit to the mediumship of Robert Murray. Tune in every other Saturday to Peaceful Planet, live on BBS Radio Station 1 at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 6 p.m. Central, to hear music from the angelic realms, inspired tracks from The Halfbeat, John Lennon, George Harrison, Frank Duvall, and Michael and the Band, and hear the wonderful messages of love and peace from Lady Diana, John Lennon, the Archangels, and our Ascended Masters. Each week, we bring you cutting-edge world teachers, and we share with you profound work like the Jesus Mysteries, the Ascension Series, and other divinely inspired messages and music, all in an effort to increase the vibration of love and peace on the planet. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone, to the Peaceful Planet Show, where we feature the Holy Grail series, and we have a fabulous guest with us tonight. Her name is Margaret Starbird, a very renowned and wonderful researcher into the mysteries of the Magdalene and the Holy Grail, and she's uncovered a vast amount of material in a scholarly way that will just completely rivet you off your seats tonight, folks. So please stay tuned as we explore the mysteries of the Magdalene and Jesus. And it's been going on here since 2:05 on the Peaceful Planet. We're sending out a vibration of peace and love and the divine feminine. For those of you that resonate with the divine feminine, the show is going to be overlighted tonight by Mary Magdalene and Mother Mary, Princess Diana, and some of the other divine feminine masters and saints that are in the heavenly realms. And I will be bringing through a message shortly from Mary Magdalene. And I wonder if some of you are also hearing the call to the Magdalene and the divine feminine goddess energy, calling us to gather together around Mary's teachings, which have been widely suppressed. Would you like to be part of a prayer group or a Magdalene group? If so, I'm planning to honor Mary on her feast day of July 22nd with a one-hour program on Zoom US, where we will be able to have a small conference get-together, and I will bring through messages of Mary Magdalene and do a Q&A. And these are going to be excerpts from my new book, and we will also have a live session with Mary on the Divine Feminine and the Divine Feminine Angels that will be coming through for any need that you may have. So she will come forth with some hidden knowledge and mysteries, and we will invite you to the Circle of the Rose that day. So if you would like to be part of the Magdalene phone call on Zoom USA, you can get in touch with me through the BBS network on my show page, The Peaceful Planet. You can also reach me on Facebook at Marcia McMahon. It's spelled Marcia, but it's pronounced Marcia. And you can reach me at marciadi2002@yahoo.com. And I want to also mention one thing before we go on to our fabulous guest this evening, Margaret Starbird, so do stay tuned. I want to let you know that my books have been placed in a bookstore in Indianapolis called New Age People, and I have the four other books, the two with Princess Diana, one with John Lennon, and one on Archangel Michael, and they are available at this wonderful place called New Age People in Indianapolis, a suburban area, and you will be able to take a workshop with me in September on the 30th from 1 to 4. Should you be interested, again, I gave my contact information out already. So I'm also wrapping up my newest title called Mary Magdalene's Secrets of the Holy Grail, the Holy Bloodline, and the Divine Feminine, and this title will be going out to publishers soon. So I would ask all our listeners to just send me the highest and best publisher for the job that I have in front of me. And so I would like now to turn and highlight our very special guest, Margaret Starbird, a very famous scholar and wonderful researcher who discovered by thinking out of the box that there was some corruption and hidden material the Catholic Church was hiding from the public, and she's going to go into that. She also discovered that Mary of Bethany was Mary Magdalene, and as I'm reading this, I'm getting chills. So let me introduce you then to our guest, Margaret Starbird. She holds a BA and MA degree in comparative literature from the University of Maryland and did graduate study on a Fulbright student fellowship at Christian Albrechts University in Kiel, Germany. She later studied at Vanderbilt Divinity School in Nashville, Tennessee. She was a cradle Roman Catholic. Starbird taught scripture classes for adults and CCD for many years and later presented lectures and retreats on reclaiming Mary Magdalene and the sacred feminine of Christianity. Starbird has been interviewed for numerous TV documentaries and is the author of several widely acclaimed books about the sacred feminine in the Christian tradition. She's authored Women with the Alabaster Jar, The Goddess in the Gospels, Reclaiming the Sacred Feminine, both cited by Dan Brown as significant sources in his best-selling thriller, The Da Vinci Code. A further book about Mary Magdalene, Mary Magdalene, Bride in Exile, was published in 2005, and this is the title we're discussing with Margaret this evening. Her other titles include Magdalene's Lost Legacy and The Feminine Face of Christianity, both published in 2003, and co-authored with Jungian therapist Joan Norton, 14 Steps to Awaken the Sacred Feminine. And Margaret Starbird and her husband of 50 years reside in the Pacific Northwest. So I'd like to welcome you warmly to the Peaceful Planet. Thank you so much for appearing on BBS Radio Network and giving us your insight and incredible wisdom and scholarly research, Margaret.
Well, thank you so much, Marcia. I'm so glad we were able to connect today.
Well, I am too, and I feel as I was reading your bio, I felt Mary Magdalene's presence with us as we go over your marvelous material. So I have read the book that we were talking about, Mary Magdalene, Bride in Exile, but you've covered a wide range of topics, and I would like to ask you how you first became interested in the search for the Holy Grail and how you discovered the sacred feminine in Christianity.
Well, of course, that's a long story. I guess everyone knows that when you start your journey, you really don't know that you're on the path, and then suddenly things crystallize along the way. I belonged to a prayer group years ago at West Point when my husband was teaching cadets at the USMA, United States Military Academy. It was a small prayer group that was formed after a Life in the Spirit seminar. And they had been shown through prayer that there was something missing from the foundations of Christianity, and that if we prayed as a group for, you know, as long as it took, that God was going to reveal to us what was missing. And so then years later, in another venue, another place, another time, I was shown a friend of mine told me about a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I don't know how many of your listeners have heard of that, but it was popular in the early 80s and then, of course, had a life of its own after that.
It's a great book.
But when I went to the library to check out the book, it said that Jesus Christ was probably married and that his bloodline had survived in Western Europe. And I was appalled because I was this nice Catholic mother of five singing in the choir, and then suddenly I'm faced with what seems like total heresy to me. So I dropped the book, ran from the library, and then a few years later, another friend told me she wanted me to read a book called In God's Name about the alleged murder of Pope John Paul I. He was a little...
No, I haven't read that one, but that was that must have been a real eye-opener too, huh?
It was. What I wondered was, well, what else are they hiding under the rug? So then I went back to Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and read that book 2 years after I'd first been told about it. I went back to the library and checked it out. And what it really did was to open up a whole can of worms that I'd never, ever considered, and I thought, it has to be blasphemy. I just can't believe any of this is true. The church would have told us. So I set out to research it, and I told one friend about it. Actually, if your listeners are really interested, this whole story of my journey is written up in the book called The Goddess and the Gospels. And that's the story of
my
journey.
Okay.
Yes, The Goddess and the Gospels is the title. And it's called Reclaiming the Sacred Feminine. And it tells about this little community that I belong to and the fact that they prayed for me the whole time while I was researching. They were my prayer support. And I would call them up in different ones and run things by them, and they'd say, oh, how can that be true? And then we would go I'd do some more research, and then I'd call them back. And that went on for years. And finally, one day I called Mary, my closest friend in the group, and I said, I think God is trying to show me that the missing thing that we were shown in our community, the foundation, the crack in the foundation, was actually the loss of the bride. And she was just dead silent, and she said, that can't be true. I mean, the church would have told us for sure. There's no way they could keep a secret like that. And I said, well, I need you to go pray about it. So a couple days later, she called me back, and she said, I prayed about what you said, that there was this, what I called it was a design flaw. There was a design flaw in the church, and it was the lost bride, the loss of the whole sacred feminine as partner. And so she apparently had prayed about it. She said, I have to tell you this story. She said, my husband was another Army engineer like my husband. Ever since we moved into our new house in Virginia after Christmas, we have had trouble with our master bedroom bathroom because the toilet leaks. She said, he finally authorized me to call the plumber. So today I got the plumber in there, and he showed me a hairline fracture around the basin of the commode, and he changed it out and brought me a new one, same make and model, she said, and he installed it in the bathroom. And after lunch, I went in and flushed the toilet again, and it's still leaking. She said, so this time I crawled around the toilet myself, and I found a hairline fracture in the same place. She said, it's a design flaw. It can't hold water. But she said, the problem is that there's one word that's written on my commode, and it's church. The name of the manufacturer is church. She said,
oh,
so now I believe,
how very
I believe
odd.
Everything you ever said about the church, and the design flaw.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, that it was amazing, because it was one of the things we noticed along the way is that when God had a message he really wanted to get through to us, he would go into amazing measures to make sure we got it. And so in this case, she had been reluctant to believe that there was anything to what I was saying. And then when this happened, she said, I now believe everything you ever said about it. It was like all at once this revelation with her design flaw. So anyway, but that's how it started, really, with reading Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Must have a prayer support group, although, I didn't when I was receiving messages from Mary back in 2004 and 2005. I received messages from Mother Mary and Mary Magdalene when I did my first show on the Holy Grail Mysteries, which was covering the Da Vinci Code. And that I got it directly from Mary of Bethany, who identified herself as Mary Magdalene. So you kind of have to have the courage to go out on that limb and examine whatever extant gospels and other material that you were looking at the time, and then you need at least one or two people that will pray for you and believe in what you're discovering, because without that, you're really out on a limb, and you have to be willing to, pay the consequences of people rejecting you and throwing out your theories and thinking you're a nut and everything else, So I know how that is when you come up with a wild discovery that it's really hard to believe at first. But now
wild.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I continued to research then, and I wasn't ready to write the book yet, but eventually the first thing I wrote was a little story that's in the beginning of the book called The Woman with the Alabaster Jar. And that was the story of how could this have happened? What ever happened so that we could... How could we have lost the bride? How could the church have lost the bride? I mean, when you think about it, partnership is the model for everything on the planet, practically. Some kind of partnership. You can't do it alone, as you just pointed out. So
the masculine hierarchy is the problem with all the world's religions right now. It's not acknowledging the complementary part of God-Goddess, because there's Goddess and there's God. You can't get very far in this world without a mother, you know? So the mother female goddess is preeminent, I feel. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. It's just that the whole idea of partnership, sacred partnership, was at the heart of the Christian message early on. And when I went back to research it all, I found so much evidence that had been either just ignored or just totally passed over. I don't know. It's not so much that they squelched it. They just emphasized all the other things instead. And then they called Mary Magdalene a prostitute, of course, and that didn't help. So we had to rescue her from that slander before we could even examine the fact that she might have been bribed.
And a penitent at that in a cave somewhere, which I do believe she was in the cave in France quite a few years, because she had to be in hiding from the authorities, the Roman authorities. But, do you think it was deliberate, or do you think it was because all the disciples at the time of the crucifixion were under scrutiny from the Romans and would have been, you know, arrested and possibly had the same thing happen to them?
Well, there's a couple things there. One is that the Jewish authorities were every bit as dangerous as the Roman ones, because they were accusing Jesus of blasphemy. And so so they had really were in danger on two fronts. And when Rome and the Jewish Sanhedrin were confronted on Easter morning with an empty tomb, they must have been apoplectic, because suddenly, instead of a dead prophet, they're faced with people in the streets proclaiming that Jesus had risen and that he was a god like Tammuz. Tammuz being one of the gods of the ancient fertility cults, from the god-goddess fertility cultures of the ancient Near East. And so they have the people declaring that Jesus is risen, and that makes him a god. And so, you know, they must have panicked. And my story that I wrote, the one that's in the Alabaster Jar book, suggests that Mary was sitting there alone in the garden on Easter night, Sunday night, and Joseph of Arimathea shows up and says, you know, I have to get you out of town. I promised him I'd keep you safe. And Mary says, you know, Joseph, I don't care what happens to me. I'll just stay here and you go do what you have to do. And Joseph said, no, I promised him. I can't leave you here alone. There's too much danger. So I think they lost her because they tried so hard to save her. The friends of Jesus, in the person of Joseph of Arimathea, who in legend is always given credit for being the custodian of the Grail.
He was the protector of everyone, and I've worked with Joseph in the spirit realms too. And you're quite right. He was the protector of Mary Magdalene, and she lived at his house in Bethany. The Bethany home was where most of the closest disciples to Jesus were right before the crucifixion, and that home belonged to Joseph. And as I understand it, Joseph was uncle to Mary Magdalene. He adopted her. So that's my understanding. So there was a protection.
Well, I don't know anything. I mean, I'm not aware of your work or the messages that you've gotten. I just know from my research of the legends, the French legends and others, that he was always known as the protector of the Grail, or the custodian of the Grail. And then later the Knights Templar become the custodians, or the guardians of the Grail family. And that's also an interesting connection later. But the legends, of course, go to France.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So your understanding is that my understanding, too, is that they went to France for refuge. But I understand, too, that they went to Egypt first, and then something
happened. That's right. That's what I have in my story. That's what I have, too. I have them escaping into Egypt, and then later, when the persecutions from Paul begin on the Christian community, they go back to Jerusalem in my story, or in my, I don't know if I wrote that part up. I don't think I ever did, but it's in a novel I've written that I've never published, so it comes later. But anyway, the fact is, I think they went back to Jerusalem and got Martha and Lazarus, because the French legends say that Martha and Lazarus were with them in 42 A.D., which is like 10 years after the crucifixion, or 9, and that they have with them then this child named Sarah, whom they say is the maid. But I've never had a 9-year-old maid, but I can't imagine what good one would be. It's like, it's
well,
not
they
helpful
had
to have someone.
Story around, so it wasn't a child or something, you know, but it was the child, yeah. Sarah, you know.
Well, that's my, you know, that was really interesting how that was revealed. I had a dinner partner once in Nashville, Tennessee, a woman from France, and when I started asking her questions, she told me all about Little St. Sarah at the town of St. Mary's by the Sea, where these people had come ashore in the boat. And I remembered this story, and I'd even been to St. Mary's before, but I didn't get all the connections. And I said, well, who's St. Sarah? She said, oh, she was the little girl on the boat. And I said, oh, really, a little girl on the boat? Well, I went home that night and looked up Sarah's name in a concordance I have, and it said that Sarah means princess in Hebrew. So we
Sarah
have a legend that says there's a little girl whose name is Princess on the boat. And she's,
very good.
Of course,
you connected
you
all
the
dots.
Yeah, it's amazing. If you know the Grail story, then you know that this word, the Holy Grail, the old French word, is, if you divide it after the G, it's S-A-N-G, and then R-E-A-L, or R-A-A-L, Sang Grail, and it means blood royal.
Yeah,
so you have
exactly.
a legend that says Mary brought the blood royal to the coast of France.
And
but you don't carry the blood
did.
Royal in a jar.
Yeah,
it flows in the
did.
Veins of a child, right?
Yeah,
so that's
exactly.
what that whole legend actually meant.
So the Holy Grail is really Sarah and the continuation of the bloodline, you know. So that's mm-hmm. quite correct. And it's interesting that your research led you to all these clues. And you're not intuitive like I am, but I'm also a scholar, and I've looked at alternate texts, like I've looked at the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, too, which is, it's got, contains some hidden clues there with the, you know, the dialogue of Mary having a dialogue with Jesus, and then Peter comes in and says, share your dialogue, and then he also tries to make Mary less, why should we believe you kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, well, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, I'm sure you've looked at that many times.
I have. And the scholars who have really talked about that and examined it, Karen King and Elaine Pagels among them, have said that because it's a second or third century text, it's probably a text that was written in the spirit of Mary Magdalene, even though maybe she didn't write it herself, but that it was created in her spirit, and that they were showing that Peter's church was downgrading or de-emphasizing the importance of Mary's church. And Mary's church, of course, is the church of direct communication with the beloved, as opposed to indoctrination by priests and prelates. You know, the church
exactly.
of indoctrination versus the church of enlightenment.
Yes, and so, and she was definitely teaching basically the way, and she was teaching an inner way mastery, as I understand it. And Jesus... outer church was to be Peter, but he had appointed Mary as his chiefest disciple on the inner way mastery, which would be the divine feminine. And that's part of what my...
Yeah, it's the way of the heart.
Yes.
That's the whole thing. And in my rosary, I have this prayer the prayer to Mary Magdalene. It says, teach us the way of the heart, because that was her way. And Jesus joined her on that way. But she's the exemplar of the devoted disciple of Christ. She doesn't say, look at me. She says, look at Christ. So it's a mystery.
It's very beautiful.
She's the bride of the Easter mystery.
She is. And thankfully, they left at least that much in the Bible. But I believe
that
it was deliberately obscured. The French bloodline and the Templars were persecuted and eliminated because of their so-called heretical beliefs. But I believe that it was all, you know, held in France for many centuries until, I guess, they eliminated Dagobert. That was the last one remaining of that Merovingian line. But it really gets complicated, but it's very interesting. So how does the ancient cult of sacred marriage fit together? I know there's this Isis cult, and there's other cults that are predate the cult of Mary Magdalene and Jesus and the Holy sacred marriage. But I believe in sacred marriage.
Well, yeah, it's indigenous to our, I guess, our whole psyche is to have this balance of masculine and feminine at some at some level. Plus, in the biological world, it's obvious that it has to be, it's the life-giving principle, if you will. And in fact, that's what the sacred marriage was. It was a celebration of the return of the life force in the springtime in these ancient fertility cults. And the cults actually vary from one region to another, and they have different names and of the god and goddess couple. But you know, you're aware of Isis and Osiris. There was very anciently in Sumer, Inanna and Dumuzi, Ishtar and Tammuz. I'm trying to think, Venus and Adonis, I guess, Attis and Cybele. I mean, there's about six or eight couples that you can name who were part of these ancient fertility rites. And what happened was they would have typically a marriage rite in the springtime, early spring or even at New Year's, and they would celebrate their union with 7 days of festivals or whatever it was in their in each culture. It probably differed. There's all kinds of ancient poetry that you can read from these rituals of the ancient world. Samuel Cramer comes to mind. He published a bunch of ancient epics and love poetry from these rituals. But anyway, the point is that that all these different cultures celebrated more or less the same thing. It was the bride and bridegroom. The bride anoints the bridegroom, and they go together into the bridal chamber. They celebrate their nuptials. And then the joy from their union, if you will, spreads out into the crops and herds and into the nation, and everybody lives happily ever after. So it's this great time of celebration and unification. Then later in the spring, around Easter time, it's the vernal equinox. The bridegroom is arrested, tortured, mutilated, executed, and laid in the tomb. And when the bride goes to mourn the death of her beloved on the third day, usually, he's found resurrected in the garden, and they have this beautiful reunion. And it's a celebration of the return and the eternal return of the life force in the spring in the northern hemisphere. So that, I mean, all these different cults had the same message was that life returns. And
yes,
life
I taught art history, and I remember the cult of Isis and Osiris, and it was very similar. And then you speak well of all these other cults that existed. But although they were cults and they had, adherents and believers, and the theme repeats itself, I believe that the crucifixion and the resurrection actually happened.
That's the point. That's the point. Yes. So here in our Christian tradition, we have an actual historical figure, not just a myth, but we have a historical figure and his bride who actually embodied the ancient myth, if you will, of the sacrificed king and his beloved. And so that's what gave this Christianity so much power to survive all these years, is because at the very heart they have this divine couple, if you will, of a bride and bridegroom who embodied in history, in their persons, they embodied this ancient belief in the sacred marriage. It's really quite an incredible story.
Yes, and it would be nice if the Christian churches would welcome this information as it's being uncovered, thanks to your books and then the Da Vinci Code and others like myself who work with the spiritual realms and are uncovering the same hidden mysteries. And there are a lot of people now that believe that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, and they don't have a problem with that in any way, whether they're Protestant, Catholic, or non-denominational, or whatever. But I think the more fundamentalist people and the really strict adherence to the doctrines will never believe it. But I think it will be gradually incorporated into society. What are your feelings about that? I know you're working to help people awaken.
Well, the point is that partnership is such an important principle to ground our psyche. In the Western world, we've gone off with this all-male psyche, so everyone prefers boy children and goes on from there for hundreds of years. I mean, look at Henry VIII. He executed a wife because she had a daughter. I mean, that's pretty sad. my feeling here is that if people knew... Well, okay, let me bring it up this way. I wrote a book after I wrote alabaster jar and got us in the gospel. I wrote a book called Magdalene's Lost Legacy, and it's about the number codes in the Old Testament and in the Gospels.
Oh,
and the number codes in the Gospel that are associated with Mary Magdalene's title, the Magdalene, make it absolutely clear that she was the goddess
mm-hmm.
in the Christian Gospel. If Christ is the God, she is his partner. And she, her number is reminiscent of the goddesses of love and fertility in the ancient world. And this
is—it's
a research project, if you will, and it has to do with numbers. But it's absolute proof that that's who the gospel writers knew who she was, or they wouldn't have called her that. Every single gospel calls her the Magdalene, and it starts with the letter H, which is their word for thee, and then it goes on to her Greek spelling. And when you add it up and use the right values for the letters that the Greeks used, you find out that her number 153 is sacred to the geometry of the Vesica Pisces symbol, which is the symbol in the ancient world and all over the world for the sacred feminine.
For the divine feminine, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, wow.
So you did all this research
with her name from the Greek translation or the Hebrew originally and then the Greek, and then you have proposed various theories on the meaning of the word Magdalene as well, but that is a brilliant summation of your research. How long did it take you to get to the Magdalene, the word Magdalene? And you don't believe that she came out of Magdal or Migdal or any of that?
No. That town, the town they call Magdala now, was called mm-hmm. Tereachia during her lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she wasn't from that town. What popularized that actually was a trip that Constantine's mother, St. Helena, made to mm-hmm. to Israel, and she went to Galilee and up to this town, and she said, oh, this must be Mary Magdalene's town because it's called Magdala. Well, it was called Magdala in the 3rd century when she was there, but it wasn't called, or 4th century, I guess, early 4th, but it wasn't called Magdala during Mary Magdalene's lifetime. So I went one day to my scripture. This is one of my gifts, was when I opened scripture, I often just stumbled on a passage that was absolutely very, very important to my work. And one day I asked God to show me something I needed for my work, and I opened my Bible to a chapter in Micah, book of Micah, chapter 4, mm-hmm. and starting with verse 8, it said, as for you, O Magdalene, the watchtower of the flock, through you dominion shall be restored to the daughter of Zion. Why are you crying? And it goes on from there, and it says, you shall live in the open fields, and from there you shall be rescued. And then one last line. Nations will defile you. They will call you unclean. And I looked at this passage in Micah, and I said, oh, my gosh, this has her name on it. And it's exactly
yes.
what happened to her. And it was written 700 years before her lifetime.
Well, that's the proof
so it was
of
a prophecy.
The excellency of the prophet Micah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, and then a few passages later, he talks about Bethlehem and how important Bethlehem is. But this passage about the Magdalene has her name on it. It says, the Tower of the Flock. Well, if Jesus is the Good Shepherd, what better title for her than the Tower of the Flock?
The other thing about that passage is, well, I was just going to say, this other Hebrew scholar calls Magdala the Tower. And it's Simcha
Jacobovici.
Yeah, he's hard to pronounce, but he calls it the same thing, and he's discerned the name in the same scholarly way that you have, you know.
He and I have been in contact. So it's not, I mean, I actually did an interview with him so he could use my interview on one of the films that he was doing.
Oh,
so we've shared a lot of information over the years. But anyway, yes, true. It's Magdala in Hebrew and also in Greek.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they had to spell it a certain way, so they put the correct ending on it so that it would add up to the right number. That was one of my discoveries, that the number was all important. So instead of Magdalene, they called her the Magdalene. But it still had the same root of tower. And the other thing about that passage is it says, why are you crying? And if you look at the Gospel of John, when Mary Magdalene is at the tomb, and Jesus approaches her and he says, why are you crying? Because she's crying over her beloved, right? But the prototype is this prophecy in Micah about the woman crying at the tomb. And they say, why are you crying? Have you no king? Has he perished that you mourn and cry aloud? And then it says, you must go and live in the open field, and from there you shall be rescued. She has to go into exile, and then she's defiled and defamed.
Yes,
and then finally
exactly.
She's restored to
so
her.
So it came true word glory. For word, the prophecy. That's just amazing.
It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. And so, but I got it as a gift, you know, one day when I just opened my scripture, and there it was. So I've been clinging to that the whole time, because the town that they call Magdala didn't have that name. And so where else do we look? Well, we look for the woman who anointed Jesus. And who is that woman? In John's gospel, in two places, it says the woman who anointed Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair was Mary, the sister of Lazarus. That would be
exactly.
Mary of Bethany.
That was Mary and Bethany.
So that's, and then the title they gave her was the title of the tower.
So, I mean, she had two titles, and that's what she has told me in her messages, that she was known as the Magdalene, but she was also Mary of Bethany. And it confused me for a while until I remembered when I was a very little girl, I used to enjoy reading the Catholic Missalette, and I would read the passage about Mary of Magdalene on her feast day. And this kind of gives me goosebumps to tell you this, but practically, word for word, they have Mary Magdalene in the older, missals and devotionals as Mary of Bethany anointing
Absolutely.
Jesus.
Absolutely. They didn't change it until 1960 or something.
Yeah. So the tradition flows there, and I've been to the home at Bethany. I've seen it all, and, you know, and then I remember a past life there, too. So I know that you're speaking of truth, but also the Migdal I have seen in when I went to Israel on a pilgrimage back in 2012, and Migdal is a little town, but I didn't get a feeling that she was from there. I always believed that she was at Bethany and that she was one and the same person. So, I mean, I think it's great that you've got this all figured out, but a lot of the scholars have separated her out into two different people, which makes
That's
no
right.
sense to me at all, because it's right there in the gospel.
That's exactly right. So we have to reclaim her and her family and her legends and her story, and then we have to proclaim it.
Exactly, and it's not an easy thing to do, because most people think it would be, you know, kind of sinful or, you know, whatever, heresy or some other, you know, weird notion, but that Mary could possibly be married to Jesus and have equal stature, and he gave her the kingdom within, especially the inner way of the heart, as you say. So that is very crucial, and women naturally have a gift of love in their hearts and naturally are the nurturers, and if that had been allowed to be in the tradition of the church all these centuries without it being repressed and removed and them committing all kinds of genocide to keep it out, it would be integrated where we would have a more balanced view of God, Goddess, the Supreme Being, has divine feminine and divine masculine traits. And so, therefore, we wouldn't have had all this patriarchal religion that's ruining the planet right now. You know, as I see it.
Well, that's the key is that we would have been of one heart, and everybody would have, we wouldn't have had this huge San Andreas fault, as I call it, the design flaw from the beginning.
Yeah.
So
it's
we would
very
have
interesting,
always
the
had,
tale about
had
the toilet
presence.
The toilet tail and the little the little crack with the church, you know, and you've
that
opened
so
the
crazy.
Chasm now. You're talking about the San Andreas fault line, okay? You know, it is
that's
a huge chasm because those of us that think that way, that are willing to bring the goddess into our prayer circles and acknowledge Mary Magdalene, she's even asked me, her final chapter in my book is that she wants her gospels included in the actual canon. Eventually. Now, we may see this in our, you know, lifetimes, because Bible scholars, are, you know, people are always, there's so much openness now, and there's information available through the internet that was never available before. So people are awakening, and a lot of the younger people recognize this truth, and they don't go to church that much, and they haven't been brainwashed by any of the denominations so much. I mean, some have, but some have not. And some people are just plain open-minded and will do the research. And you're a pioneer. I thank you for all the great research that you've done. I loved the research on the Micah prophecy there. That was just really brilliant. But I found this out just through intuition and knowing this and her messages. But I also looked elsewhere in other Gospels and discovered, you know, her Gospels and the other Gnostic Gospels, some of which I resonate with and some I don't. But there's just so much more to Mary and her teachings, and it's long lost to history. It's like, so what we first have to do, I guess, what would you say we first have to do is honor her and bring her back in our prayer circles? Or
I think that's really important, and we have opportunity coming up right now because of her feast day on the 22nd of July.
Exactly.
So we should encourage people to host a party at their house and have a cake, a wedding cake or some kind of cake, and or cookies, I don't know. We just do these ceremonies outside and just share stories about her and her life and her messages and whatever we can think of about her, and celebrate the fact that she and Jesus were partners in the sacred marriage at the heart of the Christian story. For me, that's
well, that's
really
lovely,
important.
And I'm doing a little online gathering for people that want to hear Mary's messages and do prayers together and ask her to heal whatever they're needing. And I know she does intercede the same way Mother Mary does, and she, I mean, Mother Mary's really big in our eyes, whether you're Catholic or non. Everyone goes to Mother Mary for mother and comfort and to have prayers answered, but I like how you've got the rosary dedicated to Mary Magdalene. I really want to get one. I think that's really a powerful idea, too.
It's, you know, it's just an alternative. If you are celebrating the sacred marriage and you want to celebrate the partnership of Mary Magdalene and Jesus, these mysteries, the first seven are about Mary Magdalene's life from the gospel point of view, and then it goes into the legends. The second group, the seven legendary mysteries, go into her story and myth in France after she leaves. So
oh, wow.
The first is
how
the gospel,
wonderful.
Mary, and yeah. So anyway,
so where can you get that, Margaret? Where can you get all the full mysteries of her life in France for the rosary? You can get the rosary
you know
with
what?
Your website. Right.
Yeah, I think it's all on my website under Rosary. It's margaretstarbird.net, N-E-T,
okay.
margaretstarbird.net. And then if you go to the menu across the top portion there, there's a little tab that says Rosary, and all the mysteries are written there, and the actual prayers that I say on each prayer. But they're funny. They're different from the Marian Rosary that we grew up with in the Catholic Church, because there are seven decades, if you will, of seven prayers. So a total of 49 prayers to Mary Magdalene instead of 50. We used to have 5 decades of 10, and now these are sevens. It's all about sevens, because seven is the number for the Holy Spirit. And I really think that the Holy Spirit is the one that's... Yeah, and the masculine number is 3 and the feminine is 4, so that's 7 as well. So it's just like the marriage number is 7. For this rosary. Anyway, it's on my website, and it's also in the book I wrote with Joan Norton called The 14 Steps to Awaken the Sacred Feminine. There are all kinds of prayers and devotions in there to Mary Magdalene. It's a beautiful
book.
Joan Norton is a Jungian therapist, and she and I collaborated on this book so she could share it with her circle. She had a Magdalene circle for years down in California. And
I've done Magdalene retreats myself for a couple of years. Yeah, in Belleville, they have a beautiful retreat center called Still Point, and I did healing part of the day and then retreat in nature, and then about an hour of Mother Mary's messages and Mary Magdalene's messages and some from other figures, Jesus. And I have worked originally with Princess Diana, who works with them as well. So, you know, it's just really lovely to get into the divine feminine and have retreats and have feel the expression of the divine feminine, which feels to me very different. I don't know how it feels to you, but to me...
Oh, it's a whole different energy. It's a garden energy instead of a building energy. It's just a whole different thing.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
It really gives a lot of comfort. And I even had men at my retreats. I haven't done a retreat on the divine feminine, but maybe if I present this little meditation that I'm going to do online on the 22nd, I'll probably present some things in my prayer circles too. But I would like to get back into doing the retreats, but I'm trying to get my book finished. You know how that is.
Yeah, you have your priorities.
I'm trying to
finish
one
thing and then,
yeah,
and then go on.
Well,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I kind of multitask and do a lot of things at once, and then, you know, it's harder to finish, but, you know, you can't stay on just one track all the time either. But it's very important to have a prayer life and other people around you that are praying for the same things and calling forth the divine feminine. So I'm so glad mm-hmm. that you've been a trailblazer for Mary Magdalene, and your work has influenced the great, you know, TV programs and movies of our time. I mean, that's just really, truly amazing that you had the courage to do this. And I understand you also have 5 children, and you were doing all the scholarly research and writing and raising 5 kids.
Wow.
I've written a lot of books, but I've never had children, so I think, wow, you know, I have to marvel at you. You must be a true master in your own right.
I don't know about that, but my kids were a huge inspiration to me and still are. And we were one big happy family, and I just mm-hmm. felt the need to balance things. I don't know. I just had a path and took it.
Well, bless you for doing that. That's just amazing. I mean, I had read devotedly in the 70s Elaine Pagel's work on the Gnostic Gospels, and she mm-hmm. was going in that direction, but she, as far as I knew, because I haven't read her in years now, I haven't, you know, gone back to her work. I think she does acknowledge Mary Magdalene, too, but when I saw her on TV, it seemed like she wasn't willing to totally acknowledge whether she was Jesus' wife or not. And that's as far as I got with Elaine Pagel's work.
You know, people who have tenure in universities have to be careful what they say because they don't want to be run out of town on a rail. And so I think in her heart she loves the idea, but I don't think she's able to. You can't say for sure that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. We don't have a marriage certificate. We don't have a birth certificate for the baby. I mean, there's no proof except that we have hints here and there, circumstantial evidence, if you will, for like the Gospel of Philip, where it says that Mary Magdalene was his consort and that he loved her more than all the other disciples. You know, things like that we have as a slightly later than the Gospels. But the thing that nails it for me is the gematria, the numbering, you know, the code that I told you about, the numbering that they used in that first century and before.
Mm-hmm.
The numbering system absolutely proves that she was styled as the goddess because of the title they gave her. There's just no doubt in my mind. And it's,
now, I wanted to also ask you about this incredible symbolism, if we have time. We only have a little bit of time, and I haven't had a chance to. I have a very special musical piece at the end called Holy Grail Divine, which you will love, mm-hmm. and stay on the line to hear it. It's a magnificent composition by Richard Schulman. If you haven't heard it, you might want to pick it up. And also I wanted to ask you briefly about the Last Supper and the symbolism that you also found in the Last Supper that was done by Leonardo da Vinci on the Santa Maria della Grazia Monastery.
Great. Okay, so we know that Leonardo did the painting, and his painting was renovated between 1979 and 1999, something in there. They actually cleaned it up, and when they did, if you look on the wall above the head of the apostle on the left side, you will see a chalice hanging there on the wall. Well, just go and look; you'll find it there. And when you, it has to be a photograph that was taken after 1999 because that's when the thing was cleaned up.
It's
but they've,
cleaner
apparently
now.
It looks like. What do I want? I wrote this up on my website, by the way. If you go to the Last Supper tab on my website, you can study this. But the point was that there was this grail thing there, hanging there. And then the disciple next to Jesus, on Jesus' right, is very feminine, and that's Mary Magdalene. And Peter's hand is right there across her throat, which is symbolic because Peter's church tried to throttle her and keep her quiet, right?
And so that would have to then, be Mary.
And then, okay, so my discovery, though, was my own original discovery. If you draw a line from the cup of the grail through Peter's hand and all the way down at the very far right of the picture, there's a knot in the tablecloth, a gratuitous knot. And in the time that this painting was made, a gratuitous knot was a symbol that the painting was dedicated to the secret tradition that Jesus Christ was fully human and married, right? The whole grail story, if you will, the secret tradition that he was married. Okay, so you have this imaginary line you draw, and it goes all the way through Peter's hand to this knot in the tablecloth, but it also passes through Jesus' left hand, which is a symbol of the feminine, the left hand, as opposed to the right hand. Right?
Now, I've got to look at this more closely, because I taught art history, and I taught this painting, and I did touch upon the figure to Jesus' right, looking a lot like Mary, if you really study it. But
absolutely.
I didn't get all those details. That's very interesting. I'm going to go back on the new painting
online.
You need
to go look at it again. And then what you need to know is the ratio, the numbers ratio between the cup in the far left corner, the throat being throttled, and Jesus' hand. It's a ratio of 1:1, and then the next leap is to the knot in the tablecloth, and that's 2. So 1:1:2 is the beginning of the Fibonacci sequence, which is the symbol for life.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, oh my gosh, this is the story of the eternal.
Leave it to Leonardo da Vinci to include the Fibonacci sequence in his hidden work.
Absolutely.
Now, do you believe that he was part of the, either the Priory of Sion or Dan Brown or some secret society that knew very well that Jesus and Mary were married, and he was aware of the...
He must have. He wouldn't have painted this if he hadn't known that. He wouldn't have painted it that way. With the grail is not on the table. It's up there in the ethers. It's
saying
that the grail is not a cup you drink out of. It's something symbolic.
And what's it symbolize? There's that feminine that Dan Brown points out with the V shape, which symbolizes the uterus as well.
But that's peripheral compared to this other thing that we discussed.
Yeah, I'm seeing the chalice now. I'm looking at your webpage, and that's very interesting, but I got to get a closer look up at that. But that's very, very interesting. And, of course, Peter was the main opposition to how this got covered up, because Peter, by his very nature, was outgoing and forthright and outspoken, and he and Mary had many conflicts if you read through the lines of the Mary Magdalene Gospel. So he didn't accept her inner way at all. But that still survived throughout the Middle Ages with the women saints that Mary references in my message. I didn't get a chance to read the message, but I was wondering if there was anything else you had to say about the Last Supper and all of the clues and all of this, that he included.
Well, I would just suggest, since you were short of time, that people go to my website and read that blurb about the Last Supper, if they want, and also the Rosary
fantastic.
One. In fact, my blogs are even interesting. I hate to say it, but I still love the stuff. I'm really...
get away from it? I mean, I love what you've done with your work, and I'm going to have to, I recommend the book to all of our listeners and all of your books. It's Mary Magdalene, Bride in Exile. And the website to turn to is Margaret Starbird, starbird.net, correct? And thank you very much, Margaret, for appearing on the show and enlightening us about all of your historical clues and scriptural clues and Da Vinci and everything. It just flows together so beautifully in your work. And may we both be blessed on the sacred feast of Mary Magdalene, and may we both have good celebrations, and may we add to the light of the world by giving a greater understanding of the divine feminine working in tandem with the divine masculine so that our world becomes more balanced. It was a pleasure to have had you on the show.
Bless
and we're going to close out.
Thank you.
Yeah, blessings to you, Margaret. And we're going to close out with Holy Grail Divine by Richard Schulman, and it's an exquisite masterpiece of music dedicated to the Holy Grail and Mary Magdalene this evening. So thank you again for joining us, Margaret. We'll be back in another month. I'm going on vacation, and I will see you in August. Peace be to all of you.